Succession number 27772, Reel 3.
John Wolstenholme, Reel 3. One more question about Fasano. Later on, did other nationalities come to the school for training?
Later on, there were a number of British people came to the school. I was not at Fasano when that happened, so it's only by repute I know about it. But I understand that there were a number of, in fact, there were one or two Austrians, I believe, and one or two British. But it was, they did come later on, before we moved up to Siena. But I was not present when that happened, so I only have it by repute.
I've got, as I was saying a bit earlier, one or two questions about procedures and how operators behaved under duress, you know, if you could tell they were under duress. And what I wanted to ask you was, how could you tell if an operator was working under duress? Or what would you look out for?
Well, there were a number of things which usually in our signal station at Monopoly, we usually tried to have the same receiving operator operate to a field operator, so that they knew each other by the way they operated. They operated the key, and as in handwriting, every individual has a different way of writing. So it's just the same handling a Morse key, a radio key, in that different people move that key in a different way. And therefore, to some extent, a person who's been listening to their messages for some weeks can recognize a person. And if suddenly the way of transmission changes, they say, well, that's not Joe Bloggs. That's not the way he usually uses his key. The other thing is, of course, which is probably more significant, because it just may happen that Joe Bloggs has gone down with malaria and somebody else who knows radio procedures taken over from him for the time being, temporarily. The other thing is that if a person were really under duress, and there was a German standing behind him with a cocked Luger at his head, he would make certain agreed errors in his fixed procedures, or he would omit entirely his personal security code, which always came at the beginning of his message. Before any message came, there would be his security code, which tells us this is okay. The rest of the message follows. Now, if he missed that message out, that security code out, it usually, for most operators, would indicate something was wrong. There were one or two operators who were a bit idiosyncratic and forgot. But we usually knew who they were. But on the other hand, sometimes an operator could put his security code in, but he could put in or change the position of certain other basic information within the course of his message. It depended on what the nature of his problem was. As I say, if there was a German standing behind him and controlling him, he may know that that German would know if he omitted his security message, whatever you call it, ciphers. But he may not know if you transfer vital information which was an indication to the receiver that something odd was going on. If he were really under duress, we would find out later on in subsequent messages, because we would always attempt to carry on communicating even if there an operator were under duress. It might be a matter of life and death to him, that we carry on and try and outwit the Germans into believing that we didn't realize that there was something going on, and try and find out where and what. But we always reported any odd function like this to higher authority, that was up to 1SF headquarters, because their intelligence people and the intelligence gathering may be able to say, yes, well, we've just got information from another team just over the hill that the Germans have been extraordinarily active over in that area, and it's just possible that they may be under duress, or that they're being harried to such an extent that they don't know whether they're coming or going. But whenever anything untoward happened, a strange hand coming onto the transmitting a message, or a security warning, we would always take it on board and try and find out from all other intelligence sources what might be the trouble, what might have happened. But we would always try and carry on operating to that chappie in order to save his life if that were possible. And in my time in the monopoly signal station, it happened once. Thank goodness, only once. But it was a salutary lesson on how to behave in times of emergency.
What other problems could befall operators in the field? For example, equipment failing, or weather, or...
Equipment failure could happen at any time, and it was surprising it didn't happen more frequently. The B2 set obviously operated either on mains electric supply or battery. Not everybody in the field had access to mains. I mean, they might be camping out in the bush. There may be no places with mains electricity near them. If they had batteries, they had to have a means of recharging it. Ideally, it would have been very nice if they all had car batteries and a car to recharge it by driving around the countryside. But most of them didn't. You couldn't go around to the local shop and buy a dry battery to replace it, obviously. You had to devise ways of recharging those batteries. And the commonest way was on a static bicycle with a dynamo. But the other thing was that all this assumed that you were fairly static geographically. But there were times, and there were several of them, when these people, our people that is, with trying to make radio contact, and they were being chased from pillar to post by the Germans, sometimes into the almost impossible places for them to make radio contact with us. They didn't have the right frequencies. Their batteries had run down and they'd had no time to recharge them. You know, there were a score of reasons why they couldn't come on the air. It always surprised me that it didn't happen more often than it did. But, and again, if the Germans were chasing them, of course, it was always quite possible that a vital bit, like one of your crystals, got dropped. And that was, I won't say kaput, but it was a dangerous situation, because then one of your means of contact had got lost, you had disappeared. Some of those chaps lived a very difficult life, especially latterly, as the Germans got compressed into a smaller and smaller area in the north of Italy. They couldn't get their people out, as they much would have liked to do, into France or up into the Eastern Front. They just had to mill around, and we were supposed to be playing havoc with them. And they very often, no, not very often, it did from time to time, the boat went on the other foot, that they were harrying us to such an extent to disorganize our normal radio activities.
The signals office was in Monopoly, is that correct? What were your duties in when you were there, when you were working in the signals office after your time at Fasano?
I was Derek Scott Job, who was the signal master in charge of the 1SF signal station, had been asked to go up to Siena to look around to find a suitable place for a temporary radio station to be close to GHQ, who was on the move up to Siena about that time. Temporary in the sense that it could be in contact with GHQ in Italy until such time as 1SF headquarters and signal station could move up en bloc and carry on the relationship they'd always had when GHQ was further south. So he was away for some weeks on that mission, specific mission, and for reasons I've never understood, I was asked to go up and take his place. Why? One of the chaps who'd been working with him and under him in the past months couldn't have taken over, I don't know. But I was asked to do that, and I stood in Derek Scott Job for something like 6 or 8 weeks while he was away. When he came back, of course, he resumed. Oddly enough, he had found just the right place for us to establish this temporary place in Siena. And I was sent up to be their link, together with something like half a dozen British radio operators. And we operated from a mobile signal station on a hill just outside Siena City. And we received every evening a long intelligence and situation report, digest, from 1SF headquarters, which we then, having received it, had to decode, get it typed up, and have it in GHQ, allowed GHQ by 8 o'clock the next morning. On occasions when the radio communication was not at its best, in bad weather, for example, it was a close-cut thing. On one or two occasions, we almost but not quite missed the deadline, because when we received messages, they were so, some of the parts of it were so distorted we couldn't make head or tail when it came to deciphering, and we had to ask for repeats and so on, which meant we had to be on our toes in receiving and deciphering virtually simultaneously, so that we knew the bad bits we had to call reports for. Otherwise, we'd have to wait till the next evening, and GHQ wouldn't have been too pleased with the big missing gaps in the intelligence report. But it just so happened that, again, I followed Derek Scott Job up after he'd come back from Siena took up this mobile unit and opened that link, and then a more permanent one. I forgot what it was called. Is it Unit 10 or something? Moved in. The odd thing was that when I left Siena to come back to Monopoly, I didn't even realise that a new unit had been opened. Secrecy was the great game in SOE. The left hand didn't always know what the right hand was doing, which is probably good enough. I mean, I didn't have to know that I was, there was another chappie and another unit established there taking over from me. All I did was to get orders, okay, job completed, come back to Monopoly, which I did. It was only later that I discovered what had happened.
Your job in Monopoly when you came back from Siena, signals intelligence officer. What was that?
This arose really. I don't think there had been one specifically before this, but this arose out of what I was saying about the difficulties that our field operators had as the whole set of operations moved further north, and the Germans getting compressed into a smaller space and being more able to harry our chaps instead of the other way around. People were losing equipment. Equipment was being damaged. All sorts of things. They needed supplies. Some of it was technical stuff and some of it wasn't. But I was, as the signals intelligence officer, I was asked to have a look at all the incoming messages from the field, extract from them anything that was to do with these technical problems that our chaps in the field had, and try and get to them, organise spares, new equipment, whatever they needed on the technical front. And that, of course, was by no means easy, for two reasons. The sorts of equipment, the replacements, additional equipment they might need may not be readily available to us. Secondly, even if it were available and we could draw it off a shelf in the store the same day, the problem was then to get it to northern Italy, because we had very limited access to aircraft. A, because we didn't have an air unit of our own. We had to put in an indent to the RAF command for an appropriate aircraft to do drops in such and such an area. And even when we did that, we still had, with the limited number of aircraft available for that sort of work, we still had to share our Italian demands with the Yugoslav demands, the Austrian demands, the this demands, that demands. You know, we weren't the only people making SOE units making these requirements, requests. So it was quite a puzzle. Piecing out the requirements and needs and the priorities, and B, trying to organise the stuff getting there if you had the equipment available. It was quite a tough job. But it didn't last very long, because other things took over, like the movement of the whole outfit north to Siena anyway. And at that stage, I went north and resumed my duties with the school when it moved from Fasano to Siena.
Just before we come to that, when you were in your role as signals intelligence officer, were you able to get any feedback? Did you ever meet any of the wireless operators who had come back from the field, or even liaison officers, BLOs, did you ever meet any of them before they came, before they went, or even?
I met a few of them before they went as part of the briefing. When I was at Fasano, at the school at Fasano, one of the jobs that I might be assigned towards was briefing a liaison officer or a field officer, British, that they were acquainted with the rules and regulations about ciphers and cipher operations, and that they were acquainted with the wireless operating rules and regulations. I didn't necessarily teach them, but it was one of the functions was to check that they knew these things as a double check. They had been through the school processes. It was really a final double check that they did know before they went out. So I met a number of them before they went. Dick Malibu was a case in point in one of his later operations, but there were others. I very rarely met any of them at the end of things, after they came back, because at the end of the war in Europe, things got into a bit of a turmoil. You can imagine, you know, the Germans, the Italians had already surrendered. They were out of the scene. The Germans were putting up a bitter fight to the bitter end, but eventually they realised that the end had come, and they closed down their operations and went long treks into prison camps. But our chaps were still largely tied to the Italian partisan organisations as advisors, suppliers, paymasters, and they didn't immediately stop. But everything, the Italian partisan groups began to move more freely and disperse into their own localities, and our chaps could be anywhere as a result of that. It was the end of the war, so we were beginning to think in Siena about closing things down. So at the end, I personally was so engaged in closing down this training school in Siena, closing that down, transferring the gear, handing back requisitions, furniture and buildings and so on, writing reports, and then my number was drawn out of the hat, right, next Tuesday you go down to such and such and take a boat home. You know, and things at that stage became rather confused, shall we say, everywhere. Everyone had their own agenda, as you might say.
John Wolstenholme, Reel 4. Before you left to go home, you mentioned Dick Malaby's wedding. What do you recall of that?
Well, as far as I was concerned, it was the society wedding of the year. For a number of reasons. First of all, Dick Malaby was a friend of mine. I won't say a great friend. I would love to have called him a great friend, but we didn't have enough time together. And his wife, I think her name was Christine, but I can't remember more of that, was a lovely girl and very popular in the Fannies and 1SF headquarters generally. And the wedding was held in Siena not long before I left there. And it was regarded by the whole of 1SF as being the event of the year. And it was quite a social event. But I regret that I don't remember much more than that. But it was in Siena. And I just regret that I never caught up with them again. As I say, probably the wine flowed too freely or something, but my remembrances at this stage now are quite hazy.
So then you were put on a boat home?
Yes.
Now, how did you come to be sent out to the Far East?
Well, I was still a member of SOE, and I, from Italy, I was sent home on leave after VE Day. And I was given a month's leave at home, and then Baker Street communicated with me and said, right, well, your next move is to join Force 136 in Ceylon, as it still was in those days. We'll give you travel dates when we have them available. Just stand by, ready to go to the far to Ceylon, and that's how it happened. The orders came in due course, and I just went. Did I was bid, as one does in the armed forces. Again, it was a flight out, but this time I was not in civilian clothes.
What route did the flight take?
Well, it was by flying boat from Southampton. And I think it called down in wherever, in Sicily. From Sicily, I think it went on to Lake Habaniya in Iraq, momentarily, just to refuel. We were all evacuated from the plane while they did that, and it was stinking hot. And we were given a glass of the most awful lemonade, which was tepid. And then from there we flew out to one of the Gulf states, where we landed and were put up for the night in an army transit camp, which was not very comfortable. But being in uniform, we didn't have a choice. And I should say that when I say we, again, there were four of us, SOE, all going to the same place. I didn't know any of the other three at that time. Anyway, from there, we flew the next day on to Karachi, where that was the end of the line for that particular aircraft. We were put into an hotel in Karachi until someone had arranged an onward flight down to Gaul in southern end of Ceylon. And that took, I think it was something like 13 hours non-stop flight in an RAF flying boat. Very uncomfortable. It wasn't all that cold, being in the tropics, but it was extremely slow. And it was after dark when we landed in Gaul, so I hadn't the vaguest idea we might be anywhere, as far as I was concerned. We landed in Gaul. There was a truck waiting for us that transported us all up to Colombo. We were bedded down for the night, and then the next day we had to go up to Kandy to report to SOE headquarters in Kandy, next to... was it SEAC in those days? I don't remember. Anyway, the army headquarters, the forces headquarters in Kandy, under Mountbatten.